Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Building new housing is expensive. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reports that from 2018 to 2024, the cost of home ownership increased by 52% in Alaska, and rent has gone up by 24%, with larger increases in some areas of the state. But what are the contributing factors that add up to that dramatic rise, and what can state leaders and housing authorities do to help Alaskans afford to build, buy, or remodel to meet the extreme demand for affordable housing? Alaska housing experts join us to discuss various plans today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Housing costs continue to rise, and tariffs threaten to magnify that problem. How much of the rapid increase is due to rising labor costs, and how much is materials? And what can we do to build more housing in Alaska to help make it more affordable for families? Here to help us better understand all the factors that complicate the work of trying to keep the cost of housing manageable are people who work on exactly that. Brian Butcher is the CEO of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. He is in the studio with us today. Thanks for being here, Brian.
My pleasure.
Jacqueline Peta is the president and CEO of Tlingit and Haida Regional Housing Authority. Jacqueline also serves as the co-chair of the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, as the Tribal Advisory Committee. And she joins us from the studios of KTOO in Juneau. Hello.
Hi.
Thanks.
Welcome.
Thanks so much for being on with us today. And also in the Anchorage studio with me today is Graham Downey. Graham is a special assistant to Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance on housing and transportation for the city. Hello and welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Home building prices vary quite a bit across the state, but Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, AHFC's own numbers show that in 2018, the average new home construction cost was just under $317,000. And in 2024, the price was just under $420,000, more than $100,000 higher in 6 years' time. For all of you, start us off with an overview of housing stock in Alaska. Graham, start off with the need for South Central, the Anchorage bowl, and then we'll zoom out a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So in Anchorage specifically, we're looking at a need of about 1,000 homes a year, and that's about half rehabilitation, so about 500 rehabilitations and 500 new constructions every year based on some data about overcrowding and, sort of the loss of our existing housing stock as it ages. Currently, though, we're only building a couple hundred a year, so we're way below the mark of where we need to be.
All right. So thank you for succinctly laying that out. Jacqueline, what communities that Tlingit Haida serve are you seeing have the greatest need?
So all of our rural communities, you know, we serve 12 tribes in Southeast Alaska, including Juneau and the Douglas area. And Juneau and Douglas area obviously has the greatest need because they have the most population. But in the villages, it's just as extreme on a pro rata basis.
All right. And Brian, give us the statewide, kind of the zoomed out overview, and how Alaska compares to other rural states for housing age, condition, and need for more.
Yeah, I think that there's a housing need across our entire country. There's very few states that don't see it. And the big problem is the cost. We're seeing the cost of labor being high across the country, probably even worse here. Materials have skyrocketed, in particular since the pandemic, with supply chain issues. Of course, even worse in Alaska because we have to pay the transportation costs. And a lot of our communities don't have a lot of land. And so you're really seeing pressures occurring in Alaska even more than you would see it down in Lower 48. And if I could add one more thing,
sure.
We saw almost all of the housing built in a lot of our urban areas, Anchorage, Fairbanks, during the pipeline years. The 70s and the 80s, we didn't have state building codes. They were just built. Whoever, you know, the joke was whoever could find a tool belt to strap on could be a developer, could build a housing. And so as a result, not only are we looking at housing that's 40, 50 years old, in many cases, it was not built very well 40 or 50 years ago. So the quality of the housing we do have is at a much lower level than I think you see in rural areas in other states.
And I want to talk more about that in a bit, but you noted that many communities lack buildable land. Talk a little bit more about that, because what is needed? We know there's plenty of open land in our state, but what are the things needed to make building on that land feasible?
I'll start with Anchorage, where, you know, you look around and, of course, you see land everywhere you look, but it's federal land. It's state forest. It's areas that, you know, that we're not allowed to build on. There's also a lot of privately owned land, but a lot of it's wetlands, marsh. The cost of even getting to the point of beginning to build a house on a lot of that property makes it even more expensive than it normally would be. And so that's really a challenge. When we live in a state where almost two-thirds of all the land in the state's federal land, we're really limited with the amount of area in many of our communities to be able to find that land to build on.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could also jump in.
Please do, Graham.
I think Brian's spot on. Another, you know, there's sort of a story. If you see an open spot of land in Anchorage, there's probably a problem with it. It's either a swamp or it has some legal complication or something. Another thing, though, we do to ourselves that we do control is things like minimum lot sizes. So if you have to have a certain amount of acreage per unit of housing, that limits how efficiently we can use our land. And there's a whole bunch of zoning rules that aren't related to health and safety that do restrict density. And in some places, that's appropriate. I mean, I think we don't want apartment buildings necessarily on the hillside on septic systems. But in the core of our city, we do need to say, hey, this is where we're supposed to have a little bit more housing, a little bit more efficient use of land.
Thank you for that additional detail. And I want to drill down a bit on some of those areas of land soon. But the data collected by AHFC in March of 2024 showed here, as we said earlier, that the average cost has increased by 52%, just a huge jump between 2018 and 2024. And the cost to rent increased 24%. This is a statewide average. You talked a bit about high cost of labor, high cost of materials. Are there other factors that are contributing to those rising prices?
I think you're seeing, and again, I'll start with Anchorage area. A lot of the permitting, a lot of the planning that was done looking at, okay, ideally what makes sense in Anchorage in terms of what would a community be looking for, what would a neighborhood be looking for. It was during a time where the cost of housing wasn't so prohibitive. Now that it is, I think, and I'll hand over to Graham this issue because he's working on it specifically and I'm not. We do see a real challenge, in particular in the Anchorage area, where we've seen a lot of home builders go out to the Mat-Su Valley, where they can build for $10,000, $15,000 a home cheaper. They can finish it 6 months or more quicker. So I think transitioning from what we were used to wanting to see in our communities to what we need to take a look at and focus on with such a shortage is two different things, and figuring out how to get there, I think, is really going to help.
Okay. Anything you want to add there, Graham?
Well, no, and so thankful to HFC for also helping us try to solve that problem. But I think to build on that, oftentimes there's sort of a supply-demand problem, right? I mean, for anyone who's gone out to look for rental housing recently or to even buy a home, there's just not a lot of options out there. And what that does is, you know, classic economics 101, when you have limited supply, you're going to see prices go up. So we've historically had regulations that really focused on controlling growth for good reason, but we need to take a hard look at those rules and say, do we actually want to prohibit new housing in our neighborhoods, which is functionally what a lot of our new rules do?
Absolutely. Thank you. Jackie, turning to you, we talked about this 52% increase. It's a statewide average. But what do you see in rural Alaska for these increased rates? I suspect it's even higher.
It is. And the challenges are even greater, you know, the transportation and materials costs, et cetera, labor costs. But we're seeing the same challenges with And as we look to, you know, the lack of land, a lot of the land is owned or not available, high cost of development. And what we're seeing in the rural communities, to make it work, is the communities, municipalities, the tribes, the village corporations, the regional corporations are all coming together as partners to try to piece in what piece that they can do. It's not uncommon, like even here in Juneau, the city has, you know, turned over land to the Housing Authority for us to develop because we can do it more affordably than they could. We can get grants that they couldn't. And just to be able to make land available. Recently, Petersburg made the same decision. And, you know, the land is difficult because of the wetlands, as was mentioned. But I think when we're looking overall in the villages particularly, we use a lot of federal dollars. And federal dollars bring a lot more red tape and a lot more requirements that also adds to the cost. So not only are you seeing what a private sector developer can do and the rising cost to them, now just double it again for those that are using federal or other funding costs. And that's like environmental review challenges, you know, the BABA, the Build America, Buy America Act requirements on materials. And, you know, and then, of course, what we may actually even see, as you mentioned earlier, out of some of the rising costs because of tariff fears. So, you know, there are, you know, a number of factors, including, you know, the basic lack of infrastructure that are in many of our communities. And so you'll see many of our communities either have old or failing infrastructure or just a lack of infrastructure in total.
And of course, Jackie, I know you're focused on Southeast tribal areas, but I imagine that you work with tribal housing advocates in the northern part of the state. And if so, what are the conversations over building for the future when climate change is causing such rapid changes in Alaska, ground instability in so many areas, slumping permafrost will create big challenges.
Right. You know, and Bethel's a good example of that. They've been working with the Alaska Native Health Consortium to respond to the permafrost degradation and the flooding and erosion that's been coming because of that. And, you know, and having to use innovative technologies and foundation systems that can be adjusted, having to deal with, you know, all of those elements are really important. You're also seeing, you know, as we look at, you know, ways of trying to get materials there. A good example, North Slope, they actually worked with Department of Defense and had the military help them deal with shipping costs because as we're dealing with limited time frames and the permafrost the ice roads may not be as firm or the time frames for mobilizing materials gets more limited, we're having to look for other ways of mobilizing materials to meet our construction timelines. And so, you know, throughout the state, we're working at not only making these homes more highly energy efficient, you know, as was said earlier, a lot of the homes were built in the 70s and the 80s. And in fact, Southeast Alaska has some of the oldest housing stock in the state of Alaska and is considered some of the draftiest housing in the state of Alaska, where, you know, Talisker region, for example, has the most areas with incomplete plumbing. And so, you know, we're looking at multiple factors that make it more safe and affordable in the long run. But all of that with escalating prices is just making it harder for us to achieve. And as I said earlier, you know, the federal dollar is where the regional housing authorities primarily get most of their funds. But we were also challenged because between 2000 and 2023, our buying power was dropped by 30%. We didn't get an increase in our federal dollars at all until just last 2024, where we were able to escalate our previous amount from the beginning of NAHASDA, for example, was like 600. $600 million to $1.1 billion. That was the very first increase that we had received in, you know, a couple decades. And so we're just fighting hard to be able to sustain that increase so we can actually build houses instead of just repair and try to put Band-Aids on existing housing stock.
All right. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're discussing the need for affordable housing in our state. In the Anchorage studio with me today is Brian Butcher. Brian is the CEO of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And also in the studio in Anchorage is Graham Downey. Graham is the Special Assistant to Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance on Housing and Transportation. Joining us from the studios of KTOO in Juneau is Jackie Peta. Jackie is the President and CEO of the Tlingit Haida Regional Housing Authority. Graham, the mayor, and you noted earlier, we've heard it said Anchorage needs 10,000 homes in 10 years. You're thinking 500 new per year, 500 rehabs. What is the plan to accomplish that? And is construction underway? Are foundations being poured?
That's a great question. Yeah, and you know, one reason we picked the 10-year timeline is we know that next year we're not going to hit that. We have a long way to go. It's a really ambitious goal. So we're setting this long-term goal because we have this long-term need, and it's a long-term problem we're not going to solve overnight. There's a lot that, as the municipality, we don't control, right? We don't control federal regulations or the interest rate set by the Fed. We don't control the cost of materials or labor, a lot of the factors that go in. But what we do control, we want to change. And those broadly fit into, I'd say, four buckets. The first is regulation and red tape. So we need to make sure that our rules make sense, that they're creating value and not unnecessarily blocking housing. We also need to streamline our own processes for permitting and approvals and make sure that those processes are consistent, transparent, fair, efficient, so that people can come and get their permits in a reliable way and get started getting building. The other piece that we control is incentives. So to the degree, probably the biggest lever we can pull there is property taxes, right? And we're looking actually this afternoon or this evening, the Anchorage Assembly will be considering an ordinance that we drafted to waive property taxes for new multifamily construction. And that'll be really critical. We've heard that from many developers and builders that they will in fact break ground if this is able to pass. And happy to chat more about that piece in detail as well. And then the final piece that we control is sort of our regulations in a more positive way that sort of stick to the carrot. How can we disincentivize neglect? How can we make sure that people are taking care of the properties that they own? How can we make sure that our code is being enforced? Again, fairly and consistently, but also appropriately to protect folks who are living in unsafe or dangerous conditions so we can remediate vacant and abandoned properties and that sort of piece.
Let's talk a little bit about the tax incentive part of the plan. Excuse me. An example would be the Northway Mall, right in my neighborhood. I used to shop there all the time, really miss it. Could owners of it be encouraged to build housing in that those now vacant areas where section of the mall were removed if they were given tax incentives? Has there been any discussions about that?
Yeah. So the one on the table for tonight is primarily focused on new multifamily construction. But it is the case that that would apply to someone who is repurposing something that used to be commercial and turning it into residential. So if you were to take the Northway Mall, if you were to buy it yourself and say, I want to turn this into, you know, an apartment building or I want to turn this into residential units, as long as you built at least 8 units and they were additional units, then you could get between 20 and 28 years of property tax relief. That wouldn't apply to the existing land or the existing structures. So it wouldn't reduce the tax rolls or increase the tax burden for anyone else, but it would give you that incentive to help get the financing to help make the project pencil. Because what we're seeing right now for multifamily housing is almost no one is building it. Basically, the only builder of multifamily housing in Anchorage is Cook Inlet Housing Authority, which is a public tribal housing authority. It just doesn't make financial sense for the private market to build multifamily housing right now because it costs more to build it than it's worth. And so this sort of makes that, this tax incentive will make that math make sense.
Is the city partnering with SERI or with Alaska, the Alaska Mental Health Trust or other partners like that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And also AHFC has been an amazing partner in recent years as well, or recent weeks, I guess, even. We've got some active projects right now. And Cook Inlet Housing Authority is, you know, another group locally that we're supporting a lot. We just were able to direct some federal community development block grant funding to their Baxter project to help them ideally break ground sooner. Definitely looking out for opportunities to partner with folks to deliver the housing projects we need.
Let's talk a little bit about building codes in the Anchorage area. Brian, builders have complained that Anchorage has a system of planning, zoning, and permitting that seems to be more onerous than other communities. Is that true? And if so, what's going on there?
Yeah, well, you know, we look at it from a statewide basis, and there isn't a statewide building code. You have to build to a state building code to get HFC financing. So we develop one, and a lot of the communities, because over well over 80% of all Alaskans live in areas that have building codes. It's just not statewide. And so we see a lot of communities that have a different way of looking at things. Many of them just kind of take our updates and implement them in their community. Some make a few changes. And so it really does vary. And so what we see is kind of anecdotal. And as I'd mentioned before, when you talk to a home builder that said they used to build in Anchorage and now they build in the Mat-Su, well, there's more than one reason why they would do that. There's more land available there. It's cheaper. There's going to be a benefit cost-wise for a builder to build out there than in Anchorage anyway. But, you know, talking about a lot of the challenges that Graham had said they're tackling to try to look at improving the environment in which home builders can build here, I think, is going to play a big role. So it varies a lot, but really our focus has always been on the life, health, safety aspect of it, making sure homes are built safe, that when a home buyer buys a home, it's going to be safe, and ideally it's going to be energy efficient. And we focus less on some of the other things that communities such as Anchorage may focus on, density and some of the other things that you would have more focus on as a community than we would on the kind of safety side of things.
Jackie, how talk about building codes in rural places. Do most communities have some system that they're adhering to, and do they need that in order for you to get financing to build homes there?
A lot of the projects that we do in the rural communities, we do receive some of HFC's supplemental funding, which we really appreciate. It makes a big difference. So we do comply with the, you know, statewide kind of building codes, but they don't have a lot of other requirements like, you know, building in Juneau or any other municipality. Now you're dealing with things like sidewalks and curbs and lighting and traffic studies and all of those things that add to a development. In the villages, you're dealing more with just the environment, the federally required environmental review, and what do you have to do to make that happen? How do you connect to the existing water and sewer? And although I will say the housing authorities across the state lead, I believe that they lead in Alaska on the BEES, you know, the energy standards and the energy ratings, because we, you know, our goal, our mission is to make homes that are affordable to live in. And so we really want to be able to make sure that the homes themselves are energy efficient. But we don't have a lot of the amenities. You know, you don't see green spaces built and other kinds of things like that that add to development sometimes in the urban settings.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Mark is in Bethel. Hello.
Hi, good morning. So I'm working in the tribal housing space here in Western Alaska. And one of the things that really drives us nuts is we can't put our hands on it, but there is a mythical policy that says that IHS, et al., everybody, won't pay for the construction of water and sewer utilities in a subdivision until homes are constructed and occupied. And so my question is, why are communities, tribes, developers that are ready to, put projects up, why are we being told to build honey bucket museums?
Hmm.
So if I could answer that question.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you have some
I'd be glad to
there.
Jump in on this
Please
one.
Do.
So there is challenges with coordination with IHS, particularly with HUD. And at the TAC, the Secretary's Tribal Advisory Committee, one of the first things we did was write a letter between both secretaries and ask for a joint consultation, which happened last year. And we are asking for, in our reauthorization with Congress, to remove the stipulations that kept the IHS funding being utilized with NAHASDA construction. And part of that is because we feel that removing all the barriers that keep different entities from collaborating together and making it work, whatever happens best on the ground or whatever's necessary, we need to make sure that we just take away all those barriers and make that happen. And so it's part of the IHS is definitely wanting to ensure that the, you know, the houses are going to be constructed, but also we want to be able to make sure that they're thinking about the water and sewer as from the very initial step, and we're just trying to put all the pieces together on the table to make it happen and create better partnerships. So that is definitely a policy recommendation of the TEAC, and we've sent it both to Congress and to the various departments.
Brian?
Yeah, and if I could add to that, we have, and Jackie referenced it earlier, we have a supplemental housing program that goes specifically to the regional housing authorities, and the one benefit of that is that we don't have the limitations where you can't spend it on infrastructure. Because in so many of our, especially rural communities, you're looking at building houses, but they're in areas that don't have a road or don't have any utilities to it or any of this other things. The federal restriction on those coming in means if we didn't have this program to work with them, that we'd just be building rehab. We'd be doing rehab on existing facilities. And this allows them. So the positive side is we have that program. The negative side is the program doesn't come nearly large enough to be able to do all of that kind of work that would need to be done across our state.
I see. But there is progress there. It sounds like you've kind of opened some of the doors to that were barriers in the past.
Yeah, state law was passed that set the program up so that we could work on it because we could see the obvious need, in particular in Alaska. When you look in the lower 48, they don't always have those problems as they're trying to build in the different states, but it's something that isn't unique to Alaska, but really primarily the big lift is in Alaska.
All right, we are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the need for affordable housing and what various housing experts are doing in response as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today, we're talking about the need for affordable housing in our state. We know that's been a long-standing issue, and we have good people here in both the Anchorage and Juneau studios that are focused on that very thing. Brian Butcher is the CEO of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and Graham Downey is the Special Assistant to Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance on Housing and Transportation. They're both in the Anchorage studio with me. And on the line from KTOO in Juneau is Jackie Peta. Jackie is the President and CEO of Thlinkit Haida Regional Housing Authority. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Peter is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I have a couple of questions today. First of all, it's great to hear a conversation on affordable housing. And one of the things I'd love to hear more about is how to remove the profit motive from the problem. It always seems to be pointed at, additional permitting or safety or something like that. And those things are real, but I think the profit motive is the main limitation to having more housing built. And that's because, you know, affordable housing is not as profitable as was mentioned earlier. And I guess the second part of that question is, we keep hearing that the population of Alaska is dropping, actually in Anchorage, and how does that square with this increasing demand for more housing and more housing units across the board?
Yeah, excellent questions. Thanks so much, Peter, for the question. And Graham, would you like to respond?
Yeah, actually, interesting questions. I think to the question about declining population is something we hear. Why do we need new homes if we're losing people? And I think the idea is, first, because we don't want to be losing people. And one of the reasons we're losing people is because housing is so expensive. Our young people can't move home. Our seniors can't downsize because we only have, you know, we've only built luxury single family housing for the last 20 years, or even since 1983, really. We just don't have options for young people looking to start a home, for folks who are looking to stay or move here. So part of the reason we want to build housing is because we want to change that trend. The other piece is, as I mentioned briefly earlier, overcrowding. We actually have quite a bit of housing insecurity in Alaska, mm-hmm. right? Because of the cost of housing, you have people sort of bunking up together? Or in rural Alaska, I know it's even more significant. You have folks sleeping in shifts just because of the scarcity of housing. And so our projections look at if we were able to build more housing, then we would have less of that overcrowding and less of that burden on families. To the first question, I think it's actually an interesting point. And one thing historically actually we've done nationwide in the last 50 years is really focused on capital A affordable housing. And a lot of times what communities have said, even Anchorage to some degree, is unless it's capital A affordable, we don't want it. And some communities even...
And what does that mean? I mean, what exactly does that mean, capital A affordable?
Yeah, I mean, you look at, you know, sort of percentages of area and median income and people being able to pay rent and restrictions on units so that only certain amounts of rent can be charged, or you income verify the people who are living there to make sure that they're poor. And what we find is, yeah, actually, those affordability requirements have this sort of perverse effect of reducing the supply of housing because they do reduce the amount of return you can make on the housing, and that means less housing gets built. So some communities, you know, maybe pick on Connecticut, for example, have strategically used affordability requirements to keep out multifamily housing. They increased the threshold from 20% of units to 30% of units in order to discourage new multifamily housing from coming into that community. So I think something we're trying to do is shift that narrative a little bit from affordable to abundant. We need more housing, so there are more options and there are more choices for folks. And I think,
Brian, yeah, pick it up there. This idea that it's disincentivized to build for either low income or multiplex housing, what can be done about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been a challenge for affordable housing. And as an example, if you're looking at seniors on a fixed income, they can only afford so much, Alaskan with disability. And so the way it used to work and the way it's generally worked across our country until about 10 years ago is the market rate housing took care of itself. The high-end housing took care of itself. The subsidies or the programs that you had to develop to help the housing was on the affordable housing side for people that flat out couldn't afford market rate. Now we're not seeing any market rate housing being built because not only is it non-economic for a developer or a home builder to build affordable housing, it's not even economic for them to build market rate housing because the rent they can charge or the what they can sell a house for isn't going to make up for the cost of it being there. And so we've tried to kind of broaden the amount of the direction we're looking on things. We used to be at Alaska Housing primarily focused on affordable housing. Now we realize that if no market rate housing is being built, it's a problem for everybody. It's a problem for people that are trying to move from a condo into a house because they now have a family they didn't have when they bought the condo, but they can't afford and they can't find any housing. People that have been living in an apartment and have the money to now buy a condo or a starter home can't do it because it's not available. So everything is kind of frozen in place a little bit. Mm. So we've developed some programs where we can kind of help more broadly with market rate housing in the state.
Jackie, I imagine that the situation in rural communities, especially off-road system communities, is exacerbated by all of the things that we've been discussing. What is the plan for building more multi-family housing rather than just single-family housing?
I don't know that there is a plan to do more multi-family housing. Mm. Partly, it's part of like the culture of the community. But there hasn't been that much home ownership in the past either. You know, there's been a lot of rental units that is out in the villages that gets built. And whether they be, you're seeing a little bit more, duplexes and fourplexes than before, but not large multifamily dwellings in the rural communities. But you are seeing a shift to home ownership. And part of that is to also address what, you know, Brian was just talking about, which is we need affordable housing for people to stay in the communities. Younger families want to live there and they're going to improve their income. And sometimes income-based programs just stifle your ability to change your financial, you know, situation. And so we're doing a lot of home ownership, affordable home ownership. It's definitely for people who are still between the 60 to 80 and even some to 120 median incomes. But you know, once they have that mortgage, that's their payment, and they can improve their status, their financial status, without it changing their rental amounts, and getting people, you know, our goal is to really get people to feel pride in home ownership, to take care of their home, so there'll be less repairs that we have to take care of later. And so that's kind of the new direction that we're experimenting with. Doesn't mean that we're still not providing rental units, and definitely tax credit units in the places that it can build, we can do that in. Projects like, you know, tax credit leveraging that can happen in some of the larger communities in Alaska just doesn't financially pencil for in the villages. So it's even harder to find to make rental projects work in the villages without a heavy subsidy layer and without us getting that, you know, any federal subsidies to be able to make that happen. It's really, really difficult.
All right. Thank you. We have an email question here from Courtney, who says, I was wondering if you could address the effects that Airbnb and vacation rental companies have on housing availability, especially outside of the main metropolitan areas. She writes, for example, in Talkeetna, there are hardly any year-round rentals available. The lack of housing means there can't be as many workers to fill the jobs because they have nowhere to live. But there is plenty of lodging for tourists who wouldn't be able to get services here because of the lack of workers. It's kind of a bad problem, Brian.
Yeah, that is something that we've been trying to gather information on a lot over the last few years. We're seeing it across the country, mostly on the West Coast, East Coast, and communities that tourists want to go. And it's a really difficult issue because we've got people that own their own homes, and I think people don't like the idea of telling somebody what they can do with their house or their rental. But what they realize is they can rent a place for two or three or four nights a month and make more money than they would with a renter. So now those renters that are generally the people working in that community can't find a place to live. It's a huge issue in Girdwood and Homer and Soldotna and Juneau. And you think Sitka, you think about the communities that tourists are going to want to go to. And it seems to be focused much more on a local issue where really local communities have to figure out how they can deal with it. They've tried limiting what you can do with you can only have three rentals that you can provide for Airbnb. One positive I think I've seen is that some communities are putting an extra tax on Airbnbs. So they have to pay that extra tax and then they use the money that comes in specifically to develop new housing. So there are places for people in the community that need to live in the community, meaning the people that work in the community, without actually telling people this is what you can and can't do with your house.
All right. We have, by email, a friend from Utqiagvik, an Utqiagvik elder. Doreen writes, I am in Inupiaq. I finally had enough money to buy a small dry cabin in Utqiagvik. The problem was I had to move it. I have no land and not enough money saved to get land. So she says, I had to move to Fairbanks for housing. Jackie, are there programs to help in those settings where somebody might have part of it but not all of it?
Every regional housing authority has different programs, and that's the beauty of the NAHASDA, the Native American Housing Self-Determination Act, is that we can design programs that fit our needs. And others are developing things like community development financial institutions like we have, Hayakawa Financial Corporation, so that we can provide more resources in different ways depending upon the situation. And so, you know, I can't tell. Yeah, there are options out there. It depends from region to region which ones are being offered or available. But those are the things that we're trying to address, is particularly people. There are also people who have received home sites from their native corporation or something else and never been able to build on their own home, their own land. And so we're trying to create programs that can encourage more of that, too. But, yeah, the difficulty is connecting land and the building together. You know, and I think and even just to speak to the Airbnb issue, that's even an issue in the small villages. Mm. We're seeing people, outsiders, who will buy up any residential unit that will come open just so they can hold it over for, you know, summer tourist season. And so in our communities, I know that the tribes are very diligent about keeping and safeguarding a little bit of funding or something that they can purchase those units so that they don't go to outside external hands and they can keep them within the community members themselves. But it is a real effort given the interest for tourism.
Interesting. Yes. This seems like we need to look at more of that going forward. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. John is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hello. 40 years ago, when Town Square was created, the municipality instituted height limitations on the buildings just to the south of the park. Now, 2 years ago, Assembly Member Volland created an amendment that would allow 200-foot buildings to be there on the south side of the park. That would block the sun. Solar access has always been a part of the park's ability to be really wonderful. Is there some reason that 200-foot-tall buildings would be necessarily, you know, helpful in bringing more people, more living space to downtown? Isn't there other room for such buildings to be built?
All right. Thank you for the question, John. Graham, I'll give you a minute here to answer, and then we're going to take another break.
Yeah, that's actually an issue that's before the Assembly tonight as well. And I think we're hoping that that'll be referred to the Planning and Zoning Commission to take a look at it. I mean, for Town Square, the number one blocker of sunlight is the PAC. And I think we all know how much value the PAC creates for the community. I think that is our downtown, and we need to have these hard conversations about, is it more important to have, you know, a 50-unit apartment building downtown, or is it more important to prevent Town Square Park from being shaded during certain parts of the day? I think those are values we're going to have to weigh as a community over the next few years. Are things like sunlight design protections, which do raise the cost of housing, are they creating the value we want in our community? Those are going to be some hard conversations to have.
Sounds like it'll be an interesting assembly meeting this evening. We are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the need for affordable housing in Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the need for affordable housing in our state. In the Anchorage studio with me today is Brian Butcher, CEO of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, Graham Downing, who is the Special Assistant to Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance on Housing and Transportation. And joining us from KTOO in Juneau is Jackie Peta, the President and CEO of Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority. Eugene says, thank you for the great show. We had to deal with the City Building Department lately, and calling it a nightmare would be an understatement. And this was just for some remodeling. I cannot imagine how it would be for a new development. Eugene says, the explanation was worker shortage mainly, but it seemed overly complicated and burdensome nonetheless. Eugene doesn't say which city he's in, but Graham, you thought during the break, maybe Anchorage.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, we've definitely heard community concerns about that process, and that's why we made streamlining the process and cutting red tape two of the critical aspects of our 10,000 home strategy. In addition, sort of the good government side of the mayor's priorities, we need to be hiring and supporting quality staff, right? We do have staff shortages, and we came in with significant staff shortages across the municipality. We've been making significant progress in hiring more folks, providing training, providing what employees need to be successful. So that's one piece we're doing. We're also working on updating the software so people can have a more streamlined process. We have some very outdated software currently. That's always a big lift. And then, you know, we need to make the rules simpler. So on interior remodels, currently you need to prove that the whole building is in compliance with the current zoning code, which maybe non-life and safety issues like setback requirements or aesthetic requirements. We're looking at actually a change in the near future that if you are doing an interior remodel, that you're not actually going to have to do all those. You don't have to fix every problem with the building, that you can just fix one problem at a time. Because we do know that repair and rehabilitation are such critical needs. We can't make people repave their driveway when they want to make the inside of their house habitable.
You said, Graham, that a builder wants to build 250 units of senior housing. How firm is this plan? And is it known where this would be? What type of housing? Is it low income, assisted?
Yeah, this was an email we got from a developer when they heard about the multifamily tax incentive that's up tonight. And what they told us via email was that if we're able to pass that incentive tonight, that they would get started pretty much right away. This is a project that, you know, they've been working with the city for a long time on, trying to figure out all the permits and how we can get to yes on this project. And they think that this incentive that's up for a vote tonight is the difference maker. So I don't have a ton of specifics about the project. We just had an excited email about it this week. But I think it bodes well for what's to come.
For people who want to add on or remodel so that they can have additional rentals on their existing property, what, Brian, are the programs that AHFC has or are bringing online that could help with these types of renovations?
We have a renovation loan program that's become very popular because, unfortunately, when the cost of housing is too much for people to be able to move to other housing, they have found that renovating and expanding the size of their home is something that they can do. And that's much more economic than what we would normally see, which is if somebody bought and owned a condo or a starter home and now had a couple of children, they would just sell and buy a larger home. Now that those homes aren't really available, we have a renovation loan program that would take care of that. And we tried to make it as easy to use as possible. It's on our website at ahfc.us. And we've also been focused on just trying to create more new housing, because ultimately, if we're not, to what Grandma said, if we're not creating more new housing, you know, we're kind of working around the edges. And so the first challenge is land. We don't have enough land. We had a program that was put in this year by the governor, and the legislature gave us money to work with a lot of the state entities, the State Department of Natural Resources, the university, the railroad, the Mental Health Trust, to develop those lands and make them available to for purchase to build or for developers to build, to put infrastructure in. We're excited about that program. A second program also that we were given money by the governor and the legislature would bring back a home energy rebate program. We saw that 20 years ago, when we had a $10,000 rebate to a home buyer that bought a highly energy efficient home, a new home that was built, we had the home builders tell us they were more likely to build speculative homes when they knew it was going to be easier to sell when the home buyer got that $10,000 rebate. And, oh, by the way, we got a highly energy efficient home built. So we got enough for probably 650 houses statewide there. And then we also got a bill passed that has allowed us to reduce the down payment needed for Alaskans. We were limited by law at 95% of debt, and they'd have to put 5% down. Now they only have to put 3% down. So people that struggle to get a down payment now can get into it easier. And you might think, well, that's a little scary. Are you worried about potential delinquencies and foreclosures? Alaska has the lowest foreclosure rate in the whole country. Just we have a fraction of a percent of our portfolio at Alaska Housing is in foreclosure. People are very good about it. We're very responsible about it. So we're trying to help the land, the building of the homes, and then the affordability for people, just kind of three-pronged effort to try to make it a little bit better, you know, all through the process.
Fantastic. Excellent to find out that our foreclosure rate is so low. That means people are being responsible about what they're taking on, and the programs are responsible in how they're lending. A couple more questions before we are at the end of the hour here. You mentioned the Mental Health Trust, the Alaska Mental Health Trust. There is a chunk of land that runs alongside Northern Lights and Boulevard and Burgah, right across from East High. There is an old street that goes back in there. It's right where the Alaska Mental Health Trust building is. A couple of acres at least of land in there. Is that one of the sites that could become new housing?
Well, it's preliminary at this point. We are talking to these entities, and we just started. We got the money this year, and we really rolled it out earlier in 2025. But we have a lot of possibilities with all of these organizations. We're looking potentially at land in Fairbanks, Anchorage, Juneau, Dillingham, Sitka, Bethel. The list goes on and on. Now, we were given $4 million, which isn't going to be enough to partner. But what we're looking at is these organizations partnering with us and saying, what money can you provide, what land you can provide, to try to make as much as possible. So it's a little premature to start picking the specific areas. But I think they understand that, you know, this goal, traditionally they look at their land being developed for economic development, but it's hard to develop economic development when there's no place for the workers to live.
Right. And we had by email one of my favorite topics, tiny homes. A listener writes, has the subject of tiny homes been brought up? The concept of high density but single family wholly owned homes does combine the American dream of owning one's own home and the efficiency of higher density, smaller lots attributes. So what's the idea there? I've thought about why not barge up a ton of the kits and get homes built right away.
Well, good news is we're doing it. So this summer, we're looking at building between 25 and 50 sort of micro units for folks who are exiting homelessness, using partnering potentially with AHFC and others, Mental Health Trust, others, looking at those sort of partnerships that how we can stand up those units quickly this summer for folks exiting homelessness, combined with behavioral health services for sustainable sort of Medicare funding. The other piece is the sort of, we mentioned minimum lot sizes earlier. So for homeowners or folks who have that sort of financial wherewithal, we're looking at an ordinance coming up in the near future that would support development supportive overlays. So that would be on areas near bus routes. We would reduce that minimum lot size down to say something like 1400 square feet. And that would allow, yeah, a single family home, but a much more modest one that could, you know, a smaller building is going to be a more affordable building. You could have that density where it's appropriate along bus lines in the core of our city. So that is absolutely something we're looking at.
All right. And Jackie, I want to give you a last word here. The Southeast Conference found the lack of housing is the number one priority. Are there plans in place for addressing this? And are tiny homes part of the consideration?
Yes, there's plans. We've been meeting. In fact, last week we've had a series of focus groups about how to define better what are going to be the goals and metrics for this priority we're excited to take on. And, you know, tiny homes has been one of the conversations. And I will have to tell you, there's a little bit of mixed reviews. We tried to do a small home project in one of our communities. You know, it still is costly. You still have to deal with infrastructure, all those other kinds of things. So it doesn't, you know, the price was reduced, but it wasn't without a cost. And then folks needed to make decisions about where do they put all their stuff, you know, without having it outside of their home. And so I think that there are some conversations in the rural parts of the communities where it might be a little bit more complex. You know, I think the idea of Anchorage for those exiting homelessness, that's a great place for that. I think another thing we've thought about for with the smaller homes is replacement for trailers. We have a lot of dilapidated trailers in the state that just cannot be repaired any longer. There's just no way to fix a failing wall or roof, other kinds of things. And, you know, with, you know, hopefully there's this new federal funding for the Price Grant, although not a lot of folks got that funding source yet. But as this country is looking at manufactured housing, other kinds of things, that might be a way for us to address some of the dilapidated trailers in many of our small communities. So those are some of the options on the table.
And when you think about larger construction, steel is needed. For most homes, it's wood, but we need steel for, you know, multiplexes, larger construction. How are you all thinking about the onset of these tariffs and what that's going to mean for this summer's construction season?
Well, we heard, you know, and this was 2 weeks ago when we got the notice from our contractors that if, you know, we're looking at a 30% increase on wood and steel. And so we were trying to quickly make some material purchases.
Wow.
But so that's basically what we're looking at right now.
That's really huge. Brian, anything you want to add there?
Well, you know, it's just difficult to see as it's kind of been bouncing back and forth really how it's going to impact us. Obviously, if products are needed for home building that are coming from outside the country and it's increasing the cost of it, it's going to make almost an, you know, what already doesn't pencil is just going to be made even more difficult.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much to my guests, Brian Butcher, CEO of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and Graham Downey, Special Assistant to Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance on Housing and Transportation here in the Anchorage studio with me, and Jackie Peta, President and CEO of Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority, joining us from KTOO in Juneau. Thanks to our engineer on the board today, Chris Hyde. Our producer is Madeline Rose. Our editor is Annie Feit. And on the phones, Tobin Shelby helped us out today. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.